From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our connections with it. I'm Carolyn Murray, in for Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak. Well, if there's a theme to today's show, it would be how our small, almost inconsequential amounts of waste that we generate eventually add up to create major impacts on the environment as well as ourselves.
On today's show, we'll talk about the growing concentrations of pharmaceuticals showing up in our ecosystem, the plan Summit County has to handle the growing amount of solid waste we generate, and how Citizens Climate Lobby is slowly convincing politicians that our policies surrounding fossil fuels needs to change.
That's right. Mike Lewis from the Snyderville Basin Water Reclamation District joins us in the first part of the show to discuss a recent study showing that increasing levels of antidepressants are showing up in fish within the Niagara River.
Mike has done similar research looking into the concentrations of pharmaceuticals within the wastewater he treats at the East Canyon
Wastewater
Treatment Plant. What are they? How much discharge is into East Canyon Creek? And what are the trends? That's in the first part of the show.
That's right. Then Executive Director of Recycle Utah, Carolyn Walra, stops by to talk about the recent Summit County Council meeting that discussed the county's plans to manage the growing residential and commercial solid waste headed to their nearly full landfill.
And Recycle Utah plays a critical role in helping to educate the public on what can and cannot be recycled. They also help divert thousands of tons of material from the Summit County landfill. The county has identified several priorities designed to reduce the flow of waste to the landfill. We'll speak with Carolyn about Recycle Utah's current and future roles in helping the county meet their solid waste goals.
Finally, Judd Werner from the Citizens Climate Lobby stops by to update us on their efforts to affect and influence politicians and policymakers when it comes to the fossil fuels we burn and the greenhouse gases we generate.
And we don't take phone calls during the show, but you can join in on today's discussion by posting your comments and questions to our Facebook page, KPCW This Green Earth. Our connections with and impacts upon the environment. That's what This Green Earth is all about. Stay with us.
Hello, this is Reese DeMille with Republic Services, your local recycling and garbage pickup provider and a proud sponsor of KPCW's This Green Earth. Garbage and recycling containers should be placed at the curb before 7 a.m. on your scheduled collection day. Keep Summit County green. SummitCounty.org/recycle.
G'day, it's Ian from Campos Coffee. Us Aussies really love a summer as much as we love supporting KPCW. We've got Nitro Cold Brew on tap, affogatos made with Wasatch Creamery ice cream, and Mamachari Kombucha made with our Cascara Coffee Cherry. Located above the ice rink at Park City Mountain Resort next to the Adirondack Chairs. CamposCoffee.com.
This is Nanette Bush with Fairway Independent Mortgage, supporter and longtime listener of KPCW. Fairway Independent Mortgage offers personal home, vacation home, and investment property lending. Our mortgage team partners with local realtors to provide our clients with resources to understand the home finance process. Located at 1700 Park Avenue or at nanettebush.com.
Welcome to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues and concepts of sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak. Carolyn Murray joins me today as Nell Larson is away on vacation. You know, a study published in the journal Environmental Science and Technology found high concentrations of antidepressant ingredients and their byproducts in the brains and other organs of fish from the Niagara River, which connects Lake Erie and Lake Ontario. Now, how is this happening? And apparently the fish are literally swimming in drugs such as Zoloft, Prozac, Celexa, and Seraphim, among others, and their metabolites. So how is this happening? How does it get there? What are the potential impacts on fish? And perhaps what's the impact on us? Joining us to shed some light on this is Mike Lewis. He's executive director of Snyderville Basin Water Reclamation District. And he's been doing some research over the few years on this very subject. So, Mike, thanks for taking the time to come in and talk about this study and what you're doing.
Well, first, thank you for having me. Yeah, the Water Reclamation District has been looking at the low levels of pharmaceuticals and personal care products all the way back to 2007. But most recently, we're wrapping up a study with Baylor University where we're looking at the non-estrogen type drugs that are found in our local fish populations. And as the Niagara study pointed out, the antidepressant type drugs, again, the Prozac type drugs, Zolofts, tend to accumulate in the fish, and the higher concentrations are typically found in the brains and in the livers. Now, the concentrations that are found in the edible portion of the fish is typically much lower and are low enough to where they shouldn't be of a concern for consumption. But the real question is, what impact do these drugs have on these fish? And to a large extent, we don't know yet. But some preliminary studies have shown that the antidepressants do in fact change the behavior of these fish, especially when you have a predator-prey relationship. And if you're the prey and you would typically swim off and seek shelter, these drugs may kind of honestly mellow you out a little bit,
right.
And you might not seek shelter, and thus you're changing the dynamics of the predator-prey relationship.
Well, I want to cite something here in this study on the Niagara River fish. It says that the Niagara River receives pharmaceuticals, among other things, from a number of different wastewater treatment plants along that river, no surprise, in Lake Erie. Of the 22 targeted compounds that they looked at, 11 were found at part per billion levels in the wastewater treatment plant effluent, but part per trillion levels in some of the river water samples, and of course, even smaller initially levels in the fish. But you say they bioaccumulate in some of the organs. So maybe one part per trillion that's floating around in the water gets taken up by the fish, by the smallmouth bass, let's say. And then over time, the fish or those organs or the nature of those chemicals have the ability to bioaccumulate within their certain organs.
That's correct. Certain types of organic molecules or certain type of, in this case, pharmaceuticals, will accumulate and others will not. But let me take maybe a step back here a minute and just talk about how all this is occurring.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's take Park City in the Snidable Basin area. A large number of folks are in need of various pharmaceuticals. They take those drugs. A significant portion, is excreted in urine. That urine is flushed down the commode. It arrives at the wastewater treatment plant. And even though we have advanced tertiary treatment here in town, which is some of the best in the state of Utah, these water reclamation facilities, or you might call them sewer plants, were never designed to remove pharmaceuticals. So while some of these pharmaceuticals are reduced in concentrations, a fair number of them are not, and they pass right through the treatment plant and into our local streams. In this case, we discharge into East Canyon Creek, and we discharge into Silver Creek on the east side of town. So by nature, wastewater treatment plants, again, were never designed to remove these compounds, and that's how these compounds are ending up in our local environment.
So, Mike, it's kind of interesting, though, there are solutions out there for dealing with that, but there are also some barriers, like politically, with EPA funding, possibly even from a practical standpoint, farmers, agricultural rights to water. And so even if things were put in place to, you know, respond to that level of pharmaceuticals in the water, What are we looking at? I mean, it's much more than just one solution.
Yeah, let me try to narrow it down in a Reader Digest version here. Number one, there are no state or federal laws or regulations requiring us to even look at these compounds, much less remove them. So,
like there are for other compounds,
right.
Nitrogen, phosphorus.
Right. We have spent, and we're currently spending tens of millions of dollars to remove nutrients to protect our local streams. But when it comes to these pharmaceuticals, and again, you have this huge complex, you have this big cocktail of drugs coming down the pipe to us, and it's changing literally daily when new drugs come online. That is currently, I say that, the pharmaceutical issue and that cocktail of compounds are not in the form of requirements for us to remove them. I mean, we don't even have to study them, much less remove them. But we've been proactive for the last 10 years. We started this in 2007, and we have, in the last couple of years, conducted a number of pilot and bench studies to determine how to remove these compounds. And again, the technique that we have studied would remove pretty much all types. It's not a specific process that removes one specific drug. That doesn't work because we have thousands of drugs. So we know how to do that. It's very expensive. Here in Park City area and Snowville Basin, it would take us somewhere between $10 and $15 million per treatment plant. We have two treatment plants to remove these compounds. Now, you indicated the water rights. We have an issue here in Utah whereby the flow in the creek is not guaranteed, meaning we could spend tens of millions of dollars, as we have, to protect our local, say, Bonneville cutthroat trout, and we can spend tens of millions more to remove these pharmaceuticals. But then the very next day, the folks that hold the water rights can actually dry up the creek and kill the fish, and it's completely legal. So we have this, I'm going to call it a train wreck that can occur between water quantity and water quality. So that's an issue we have to deal with. But the bottom line is we do know how to remove these compounds, and we continue to study the impact of these compounds. The estrogens are of a real critical concern to us, where you can actually feminize the male fish. And if that gets to a critical point, then we may go before the public and say, hey, are you willing to spend an extra, $5 or $10 a month to pay to remove these compounds from the wastewater?
But is there's a point of no return on that we had talked about earlier, like when the male fish start to develop ovaries and that type of thing.
Yeah.
So how does that timing work?
So the studies we've conducted here locally indicate that the low level of estrogens are starting to feminize the male fish. And without getting into the science too deep, we see these proteins in the blood of the male fish that start telling the fish to produce eggs. And that's, a bad day for that male fish. The very next step is when they physiologically change and actually start developing those eggs. We haven't seen that yet. So we're one step away from the point of no return that you've indicated. If we ever get to the point where we are physiologically changing the male fish to where they're actually starting to turn into females, then I think we'd make a recommendation to spend, or at least to propose to spend this money to remove these compounds. We're not quite there yet. Do we anticipate that occurring? Honestly, yes, because of two reasons. One, our population continues to increase. We have more and more wastewater being discharged into the local stream, and the amount of water in their local streams continues to go down, or at least maintain the same level.
We're speaking with Mike Lures. He's executive director of Snyderville Basin Water Reclamation District. We're talking about a study, among other things, a recent study that came out that shows that there are increasing levels of antidepressants, their ingredients and their metabolites, showing up in organs of certain fish, or nearly all fish, in the Niagara River. In this case, that's where the study was performed. But Mike has been doing some research on East Canyon Creek, and you've seen some of these pharmaceuticals, this array of pharmaceuticals that you've looked at, and some of the fish that you've studied in East Canyon Creek.
Absolutely. We have a whole list of pharmaceuticals that we have found in the fish flesh of our local fish.
Any that stand out among others?
It's interesting.
You said hormones.
Certainly the hormones, the estrogens are ones that we're really concerned about. The antidepressants bioaccumulate in the fish.
Yeah.
We do not know what that really means. There have been some of these behavior studies done, but they're preliminary. We have found everything from DEET bug spray in the fish. We have found fire retardants, but all of your standard known pharmaceuticals are found.
And again, like you say, this truly is a cocktail of chemicals
that
go from the antidepressants to other mood inhibitors to anxiety medicines, statins, and then the estrogens and hormones. It's all in there. Even caffeine. I bet you could find caffeine.
We find caffeine every single time.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you very much. So now we're caffeinating our fish.
And not only that, but we live in a resort community. So during the ski season, this cocktail of compounds is different than it is, say, in the summer.
You can practically tell what season it is.
We don't want to go there. But this cocktail is is ever-changing. So when we look at addressing the problem, we can't look at just one specific compound or even a group of compounds. We have to look at the whole cocktail. And that's what we've done on our studies on reviewing how we can remove all these compounds.
So, Mike, are there communities either in Utah or in the Intermountain West that are using some of these methods to filter out those compounds?
Yeah, the answer is no. And the reason for that is, again, there are no state or federal regulations pushing someone to do it. What makes us a little unique here is that we have an ever-growing population. We're producing more and more wastewater, and we discharge into these tiny, tiny little mountain trout streams. So we're somewhat of a harbinger of things to come for other places. Now, there are some water providers throughout the country, including down in Nevada, pulling water out of Lake Mead, to where the water providers are looking at these low levels of these pharmaceuticals going into the drinking water supply, and they'll treat at that level. But from a wastewater side, I'm unaware of any entities here in the United States. However, over in Europe, in Switzerland as an example, they decided to install the necessary equipment and processes to remove pharmaceuticals from the 100 largest wastewater plants in the country. They just said, hey, we're just going to do this. We're not even going to worry what's there. We know it's there, and we're going to spend the money. So a little different approach there. I will tell you that EPA and others are looking at the problem. It's a very difficult problem because of this cocktail. It's not just one specific, you know, toxin. And we do anticipate something in the way of regulations in the future. I'm just not certain that we can wait that long here locally.
Well, right. Here's the takeaways I get from this. And you've been on to talk about this issue for years. You know, we've had you on to talk about this study because you've been studying this. And like you say, that this has been being studied since 2007 or so. We always say that, yeah, it's parts per trillion. These are really small concentrations. They do bioaccumulate over time, but we're not eating, you know, the brains of smallmouth bass or something. We're not at risk. But it's getting to the point where they're starting to see some of these pharmaceuticals in the parts per billion concentration. And this is what we thought would happen over time. Increased amount of chemicals, an array of chemicals being introduced to our wastewater, and the concentrations of them are going up too.
And we're also seeing a synergistic impact between different compounds.
So it's so one
it magnifies
thing,
the problem.
You're right. It's one thing to have parts per billion or trillion of Zoloft. It's another thing to have a little Zoloft, a little Prozac, a little Effexor. Here's some statins. Here's some estrogens. Mix them all up. Now, what's that synergistic effect?
And the evolutionary impacts on the fish.
Yeah,
So
there's the reproductive, there's the feminization that's going on, and then there's the behavior change. Mm-hmm. That suggests maybe their flee or flight mechanism is altered.
And the estrogens, we've been able to show that the estrogens impact the sexual breeding behavior of the male fish. Instead of being as quite as aggressive, they're more like, I'd say, at the female side of it, and there's an impact on the reproduction side. So definitely an impact, and a lot of additional research needs to be done, but the picture's becoming clearer and clearer.
And are these findings also occurring in seafood? And are there studies that are starting to unwrap that?
Most of the studies and results that are coming out are in proximity to wastewater treatment plants. So if you have a very large wastewater treatment plant discharging to an ocean, say San Diego is an example, where they have a discharge out into the sea, in the immediate vicinity of that discharge point, you know, you can have an impact. Now, keep in mind that those discharges from these large cities can be up to, you know, a billion gallons a day. You know, we're talking huge quantities.
Yeah.
So, and here locally, we have two treatment plants. And when we complete this one that we have under construction, we'll have a capacity to treat 8 million gallons a day. So little old Park City, Sunnyvale Basin, you know, we can produce up to 8 million gallons a day, and that'll increase in the future. So it kind of gives you an idea of just the quantity of water that we're actually talking about here.
And there was a study that looked at antidepressant levels in shrimp. Mm-hmm. It might have been a controlled study, but this is in 2010. The study showed that when shrimp were exposed to small levels of Prozac, they were five times more apt to leave dark, safer waters for more dangerous, brighter waters. So their behavior gets altered. So so that's the impacts. That's the takeaway. We got one or two more minutes.
You mentioned at the start about personal care products, mm-hmm. and I'm just wondering, does that encompass soaps and shampoos and shaving creams mm-hmm. and all those other things? And if it does, is it valid to start to look at organic, you know, bio, mm-hmm. you know?
When it comes to soaps and detergents, the formula has changed over the years to where those are all biodegradable now. We're not too concerned about those things. But let's look at colognes, hair coloring, you know, those types of things that you can buy over the counter, even like Tylenol. You know, those are all, you know, non-pharmaceutical products. All of that adds to the cocktail.
Mm-hmm.
And there's literally thousands and thousands of compounds in a lot of those products collectively that all adds to it. You know, I will say that on September the 30th, in association with Recycle Utah, and I know Carolyn's up next, there will be a Household Hazardous Waste Collection Day. We'd like to encourage people to come to the Canyons parking lot starting at 9 a.m. until 1. Bring all the personal care products and pharmaceuticals that you no longer need and turn them in. That helps.
That helps. But though the majority of these chemicals come through excretion.
Unfortunately, that's correct.
Urine. Yes. So, you know, we are a chemical dependent society these days.
Well, it makes you wonder if you've got fish that have this multitude of compounds in their flesh. What do we have in
what
our
do
flesh?
We have it?
Fire retardant.
That's a good question, Carolyn, because as it gets into our water cycle, what's the possibility of this showing up at the influent of our water treatment plant?
There's been some studies on it. Number one, you have to keep in mind these fish live in the water 24 hours, 24/7. So it's a little different situation than us humans. And they're being exposed to the total cocktail. The amount that's in the water, and the water folks have been looking at this, the concentrations appear to be very, very low and not nearly as diverse, complex as we're seeing in, you know, the treated wastewater and local streams. So right now they're saying, you know, not necessarily, but there is evidence that, the average American female is maturing quicker, you know, sperm counts are going down in men. Those are all classic, what we call endocrine disrupting compound symptoms. And that's what estrogens do to the fish. They disrupt the endocrine system, and those are clear signals that the endocrine system is being impacted in the humans.
Perfect. All right.
Interesting.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Mike Lohr is Executive Director of Snyderville Basin Water Reclamation District. Thanks so much for joining us, giving us that update. You know what? You will give us another update, probably another year or so.
We will.
With
be
another
happy to
study.
Come back.
You bet.
Yep.
All right.
Thanks, Mike.
Let's take a quick break for some underwriters and sponsors. When we come back, Carolyn Walrod from Recycle Utah joins us to talk about Recycle Utah's role in Summit County's solid waste management plan. It's This Green Earth. We'll be right back.
This is Chris Robinson with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties. KPCW is one of the many nonprofits our agents and company support. They are the backbone of Summit and Wasatch counties in our incredible community. More info at bhhsutah.com.
Support for KPCW comes from Crandall Capital and New Park Town Center, with new retail spaces and a year-round community development. Information about New Park Town Center is available at 801-303-5440.
Hi, I'm Tom Pettigrew from Park City Mountain and a proud supporter of KPCW. From kids' rope courses to zip lines and hiking trails to the bike park, Park City offers a wide range of family-friendly activities all summer long. More information on new summer activities and all the other programs can be found at parkcitymountain.com.
Thank you.
Welcome back to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues and concepts of sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak. Carolyn Murray joining me as a co-host this weekend. Nell Larson's away. And joining us in the studio is Carolyn Wara. She's Executive Director of Recycle Utah. And she's here to talk about the meeting that was held, that all three of us were at, a couple of weeks ago, where the County Council was presented with some options, a list of options with respect to their solid waste management plan, their future plans, what some of their priorities are. And so we're going to spend a few minutes talking to Carolyn about, first of all, what those options are, what those priorities are, and what Recycle Utah's role is with respect to those options. So first of all, Carolyn, thanks for coming in.
Hello, thanks for having me.
All right.
Hi, Carolyn.
Hi, Carolyn.
Here
we come, Carolyn.
Yes.
So
I'm just going to jump right in. Here's there were seven topics that were listed that the county folks presented to the council members to kind of weigh and evaluate and get some guidance on. And so, in no particular order, the first one was with respect to residential glass. And the idea, like, there's a lot of glass, that shows up at the landfill, a lot that's recycled. We have kind of a natural inclination to want to recycle our glass. What impact does residential glass have on the landfill? Well, it turns out that as far as volume goes, it's not so much. Residential-based glass that goes in the landfill has a relatively minor impact on space in the landfill. And that's the goal here, if you'll just indulge me for another minute. The goal here is for the county to extend the life of the landfill, right? Would you agree with that?
Right, yeah.
Yeah. All right, that's what they're trying to do. They're running out of space now. They're building a couple of new cells that will get them another 30 to 35 years. But they'd like to extend the life of the landfill so they don't have to build a whole new one 30-some years down the road. And so they talked about residential glass. Now, Recycle Utah takes lots of glass.
Yeah, last year we did 830 tons of glass.
Okay.
Between the remote bins, you know, that you'll see, you know, in Jeremy Ranch, Park and Ride, Little Creek Park, and then the bins at the center. The bins at the center definitely take a lot more, but...
Yeah, so the topic here was whether or not the county should spend money on collecting more glass and maybe purchasing a glass crusher and sending that broken glass maybe to reuse it, repurpose it, and somehow add as an admix to asphalt or concrete, or maybe as a fill material to local quarries or so. So I think the takeaway there was that they decided to kind of shelve any, let's say, expenditures on glass crusher or so, the county buying a glass crusher or so. Recycle Utah doesn't crush glass. You guys just throw it into the bin.
Yeah, we throw it in the bin and we send it to Momentum Recycling down in Salt Lake, and they crush it and recycle it there. A lot of the brown glass turns right back into new brown glass, and then Green and Clear is used for fiberglass insulation.
And why does Green and Clear not go right back to Green and Clear glass?
It must be. I'm not a glass specialist.
I don't know.
Does Chris, do you know?
I'm not sure either, but it may be repurposed in other ways. Sometimes it's crushed, and that can be used as admix in asphalt and cement. Some of it can be broken, crushed down to a fine, almost sand-like, and some of it's used in the auto repair industry, the painting industry, as an abrasive. So there's lots of things that can be done with clear.
Yeah,
some
glass,
of it's turned into fiberglass, too.
Yeah. Glass can be infinitely recycled. You can keep
crushing
and recycling over and over and over again. A lot of materials, they have a short life on how many times it can be recycled before it's not a solid material anymore.
Whereas our next topic, cardboard, not so much, has a limited life cycle. And this was an important one. This one's identified as an important priority. Yes.
Surprisingly important.
Talk about their conversation on commercial cardboard.
I think in their research, they visit a lot of businesses, not the big businesses, a lot of the big businesses like Smith's or Whole Foods. They're recycling their own cardboard, you know, and sending it to the market to get a profit off of it. But these smaller businesses, especially in Kibble Junction, aren't recycling a lot of cardboard. And from their research, you know, messy bins and kind of complicated things, and they've the staff committee here, the Solid Waste Planning Committee, identified that, you know, there's a lot of businesses that could help. Use some help with cardboard recycling.
Yeah, Tim Loveday, he's their solid waste manager, said that commercial cardboard takes up a huge space in the landfill. And that would be his central focus. If there was a way to reduce the amount of commercial cardboard, he says residential cardboard seems to be handled well. Again, you guys take a lot of cardboard. You have a baler at your place that compacts it, and that makes it more valuable when its cardboard is baled.
Yep. We do cardboard in two ways at Reseca Utah. We have a compactor and then we have a baler. So kind of a two-process system to always be handling as much cardboard as we get in.
Okay.
Well, and it's interesting, too, learning from this meeting that cardboard actually does decompose but turns into methane gas.
It turns into methane. Like, turns into carbon dioxide, too. It depends on the bacterial populations that are in the landfill. But, yeah, it can generate a lot of methane, which then impacts the county's greenhouse gas initiatives, carbon footprint initiatives, et cetera. So the goal here is to get as much commercial cardboard out of the landfill. And Recycle Utah can play an important role in that with education and awareness.
Yeah, it was great during this meeting. The county is kind of like, well, we'd love to get more cardboard. I'm like, we can process cardboard all day long with what we got, you know. And if we, you know, move to a new space with more facility, we can store the cardboard and watch the market. Right now, a lot of the cardboard we're storing, you know, gets snowed on in the winter, rained on in the summer, and then that devalues the market, I mean, the product on the market. So with more space, we could process even more, you know, and maybe we expand to a second baler.
Baled cardboard
is always the most valuable way to ship cardboard because you smush it all together, and then, you know, you can send a whole truckload of it down versus all these loose
Right.
Yeah.
So the county talked about maybe they buy a baler. And the cost associated with that. I don't know if they're interested in that. Maybe they would want Recycle Utah to purchase a new baler or somehow at their new shiny new facility. Yeah.
So Carolyn, we have dispersed recycling bins around the county for glass. Do we have that for cardboard as well?
Some of the businesses do, but we don't have it for residents. We'd probably have to do some research in how to collect that properly so it stays uncontaminated or add something on our end to sort through the cardboard before we actually bale it. If we were to do that, it's not a bad idea, though.
All right. So that's the commercial cardboard. There's going to be a lot of efforts and focus by the county staff on trying to reduce the amount of commercial cardboard from big box stores. Remember, when it's big box, that's a big cardboard box. Okay, so that's what think in those terms. Now, that segues to the third topic, which was actually the county considering an ordinance requiring commercial cardboard to be recycled, if not at all commercial facilities to do some type of recycling. That's interesting. Salt Lake City has a similar ordinance. They might adopt something along those lines. It's not unprecedented. I know the county is not crazy about, you know, launching yet another ordinance to force, in this case, commercial businesses to recycle their cardboard. But it's important, and they listed it as an important priority. So expect to see more efforts there. And Recycle Utah, again, plays a role in providing education and awareness to businesses about this ordinance.
Yeah, we have a green business program that's free for any Summit County business, and we provide a resource to them and, you know, enforcing their green initiatives. And a lot of them, it's just starting recycling. There's a lot of businesses now that don't, you know, get caught up in the landlord, the bin, the details involved how to start recycling at your business. So we're a good resource for that kind of thing.
All right, so that's to be continued. Number four, large-scale composting facility. I say large-scale because this isn't residential composting. Lots of us compost in our backyards. This is about the idea of establishing a more formalized central facility to compost food waste, landscape material, other organic material. And it was decided that this is kind of a lower priority for now. It's more of a long-term
effort.
Yeah,
they put this at a 3 to 5 year timeline. They kind of said, let's revisit this.
Yeah.
It was surprising to hear that it was designated as just kind of a low volume type of thing. And
yeah.
I just have to wonder what that means. Does it mean just because we have fewer people living in Summit County? Is that why it's low volume? Or has it been looked at in a ratio, like how many restaurants per person are in Summit County? And shouldn't that possibly push us up a little bit in terms of, you know, putting that as a higher priority because we've got all this food waste that's just going out the door?
We're certainly lousy with food waste because there's about two restaurants per person in this town. But
I was curious about that number, though.
But a lot of composting facilities rely heavily on landscaping material. So a lot of yard waste and such helps fuel, quote-unquote, composting facilities versus food waste. They're all mixed together. Some composting facilities also take sludge, biosolids, from wastewater reclamation facilities like Mike Lures. So there's a number of inputs that go into a composting facility. That all has to be teased out and explored a little more to see if a larger centralized composting facility. There is a commercial facility in the county.
Browns Canyon, yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
And they're trying their best. I think they're focused on food waste with some landscape material. We'll have them on one time to talk about. So that's a lower priority. I'm kind of hustling through these. We've got five more minutes or so. The last three, materials recovery facility, or MRF. This was identified as an important priority, but it needs a lot of work.
Yeah, there's a lot of ways you could define a MRF. You know, are you bringing everything there and sorting it out? Or, you know, in some senses, you could even call the current recycle center a MRF. You know, we're expecting you to come there and sort your materials, and then we send them off to be recycled. You know, there's different ways you can do a MRF. You know, maybe recycle center is the MRF at the most simplest factor, because you come and you sort, and then it goes away.
But it's already kind of pre-sorted,
right,
in that sense.
Totally.
Whereas curbside recycling, that which has your paper, your cardboard, your plastic all in one can, that goes down to a MRF down in Salt Lake City, where it's just dumped onto a tipping room floor, and then it's put through a series of separators, some of them human-based, people-based separators, and then other drums and magnets and spinners and tumblers and things, and separates. That's a MRF for recyclable facilities. That is incredibly expensive, is incredibly complicated to engineer and design and operate, and I think that's why the county needs to know a lot more about the feasibility. They need to do a feasibility study.
Yeah.
On whether or not a MRF, like you say, Callum, MRF might not work up here because of the volume. You need a lot of volume
to justify that.
Yeah.
However, if you take into account what it costs to get that material down to Salt Lake.
Yep.
Right.
There's your cost analysis, your cost benefit analysis on
that. I think the next version of the staff report would be really interesting to see how they divulge how a MRF will work and what will happen there.
But council members want to learn more about materials recovery facilities. Number six, education. Well, that obviously Recycle Utah plays a big role in education, and they cited that as very important because you help keep your education awareness helps keep waste out of the landfill.
Yeah, we've gotten the same funding from Summit County since 2014 to education programs, and we've managed to grow our programs and start some new adult programs, you know, like the Green Business and the Green Drinks programs that are adult education focused. We've continued to educate every elementary student in Summit County on that kind of funding. So it's been a big part of who we are and what we do. You know, you gotta.
Yeah. And all that education, although it's difficult to quantify, right? I mean, hey, we talked to 500 fourth graders today. What does that mean in terms of literally the waste or the trucks that show up at the landfill? That's a tough one to quantify.
Right.
But it does have an impact in changing behaviors.
Sure.
Okay. And then finally, This is even more focused. Recycle Utah's contract with the county, which was also identified as an important priority. You obviously have an existing contract. You're getting funding for education and awareness, and also some funding to supplement some of the cost of the materials you manage.
Yep.
So,
And I think the council, I was very pleasantly surprised with all their responses to this kind of thing. You know, they were kind of, you know, that the staff report had some things, you know, they could really get in the weeds on numbers and everything like there, but I think we've proven our role in the community pretty heavily, and I feel lucky that the county sees us, you know, to do a service contract and treat us like a business, because we are offering a service rather than, you know, a donation to a nonprofit or a grant to a nonprofit, because, you know, these are services that need to exist in Summit County, and we're fulfilling that need for that. So
I think
the council recognizes that.
Let's remember, in the vast majority of communities in this country, recycling programs are part of the solid waste department of a municipality. Very, very few communities in this country have their recycling programs run by a nonprofit, and little to none have their hazardous waste collection days handled by a nonprofit. So there is an expense associated, a great expense associated with performing recycling that you guys do. that the counties and the cities help supplement.
Right.
They help supplement.
Right.
But it's very, very unusual to have a nonprofit running these, running their recycling operations on a day-to-day basis.
And that's huge. Even we go into like federal funding or different funding programs and trying to explain to somebody outside of Park City or Utah how it works here. You know, they say, well, why isn't, you know, the county should be doing that or the state should be doing that. And it's a very unique situation that makes it tricky for us to go after some funding in certain situations.
Well, what would it take to make that transition?
A lot.
A lot.
A
political
lot.
Will.
Well, that's political will. I mean, that's what the council is evaluating. What would, if we took on more glass management and recycling and cardboard management, these are the costs, and there's a lot of costs. The materials recovery facility, that's a big cost. So that's what they are evaluating. Last thing, just a minute or so, talking about funding, you on average get how many hundreds of cars a day?
We just had a car counter installed for the past 2 weeks. The city's kind enough to let us borrow one of theirs for a couple weeks. And last year, we saw 360 cars a day on average. And this year, we went up to 405 cars.
405 cars. And typically
on a day, per day, average.
405 cars a day on average. And you also get some donations. People, you have a little drop box. And how much do you get?
$100 would be a good day.
$100
would be a good day.
So
for
I'll
us.
Do the math. That is a quarter per
math.
Car.
One quarter per car.
Imagine
cents.
If people dropped off, I don't know, 4 quarters per car. What that would mean to your operational cost.
That would probably pay for our hauling to Salt Lake.
$1 a day. If everyone who stopped by dropped off $1 in that little bin, that can, that would mean $400 a day, roughly. So let's say $2,500 a week. That's $100,000+ a year. That would go a long way.
That would be life-changing for us to have that.
Life-changing to go from 1 quarter to 4 quarters. So, folks, I know people donate and give, and that's great. But if you go to Recycle Utah, put $1, put 4 quarters into their can and make them.
I wonder if you should have an ATM that dispenses dollar bills.
It's not a bad idea.
All right. Make it out of recycled aluminum.
Yeah, exactly. I love that.
All right, Carolyn.
Yes.
We're done.
Excellent.
Thank you, Carolyn.
Thank you for helping us hustle through these options. We'll stay a pace of these in the future.
Excellent. Thank you for having me.
All right. Let's take a quick break for some underwriters. When we come back, Judd Werner and Tom Moyer from Citizens Climate Lobby join us. It's This Green Earth. We'll be right back.
Support for KPCW programming has been provided by the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, a nonprofit organization dedicated to protecting Utah's remaining Red Rock Wilderness lands. SUWA and Utah's Red Rock Wilderness need your support now more than ever. To learn more about how you can become involved, please visit the SUWA website at suwa.org.
Miller Orthodontics supports KPCW and their involvement with area youth and teens. Speaking of youth, did you know Invisalign has a specific type of aligner just for teens? Over 3/4 of our Invisalign patients are 19 or younger. More information about Invisalign Teen is available at m2ortho.com.
Welcome back to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues and concepts of sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak, Carolyn Murray here with me as a guest co-host this week. And in the studio for our final segment is Judd Werner and Tom Moyer. They're both members of Citizens Climate Lobby. And they're here to talk about some events and also some interesting work Tom has been doing with Mia Love or so, and the Climate Solutions Caucus. We'll get to that in a minute. First, Judd, you got some events coming up. Let's get those announced for folks.
Okay. Well, there will be more local press coming out on this, but we're real excited. We have a 2-part climate education series that we're going to conduct in collaboration with the Park City Interfaith Council on 2 successive Sunday evenings in October. And the dates are October 8th and October 15th. On October 8th, the venue will be Temple Har Shalom.
Mm-hmm.
On October 8th, we're going to bring a couple of professors, Dr. Rob Davies, who's spoken here before,
yes.
will speak about climate change.
Great.
Rob gives a great presentation.
Great talk.
But this time we're going to pair him with someone else, an associate professor from Brigham Young by the name of Chip Oscarson. And Chip's research and publication special interest is environmental ethics in modern society. So he's going to approach climate change from that perspective.
Good.
And then it seems that whenever we do one of these educational sessions, people at the end want to know, well, what can we do? And so we're going to follow that up on the next Sunday, October 15th, with what we're calling a solution session. And we're still finalizing participation in that session, but it'll likely include presentations from Citizens Climate Lobby, Summit County, Park City, and we're trying to engage some of the other entities that will provide local citizens with concrete actions they can do to address climate change.
Perfect. And both those events are going to be held at Temple Har Shalom.
Yes.
October 8th and October 15th.
What time are we?
Yes, so six o'clock in the evening.
And there'll be more information going forward on your website or
in
public service
press.
Announcements
yeah.
here on the station, et cetera.
Yeah.
So that'll be really good. Rob Davies is a great speaker, full of great information about climate issues.
And has spent his entire career basically
working on climate-related issues.
Right.
So that's really looking forward to that, and we'll help promote that here on the show, too.
Thank you.
All right, so let's talk, though. This is really interesting because Tom Moyer is the liaison to Mia Love?
Yeah, that's correct.
Congresswoman Mia Love. And she joined something called the Climate Solutions Caucus earlier this year?
It was just after the election.
After the election?
Yep.
Wow, okay. And you played a role in that?
Yeah, so I've
so
been...
So talk about that.
At the time, I was a constituent. I lived in District 4. Now, I've recently moved up here to Park City.
Mm-hmm.
So along with the rest of her District 4 CCL members, we've been talking to her office for 2 years about climate change and about her taking an active role in this issue. So,
let's be clear, she's very Republican, very conservative.
Right, right. And also to be clear, we need conservatives
to
take the lead on this issue. We're not gonna solve this issue with Democrats alone. Or with liberals alone.
Right.
We'll solve this issue when we have support in the Republican Party.
So what was compelling to her?
I can't tell you for sure.
Wasn't one single thing?
Yeah, no, but I can tell you in general, because she's told us this, the approach that we've taken, and this is true of all of Citizens Climate Lobby, not just our members in her district, but the approach we've taken of leading with respect and appreciation,
mm-hmm.
right, as opposed to leading with hostility, and then letting them know that we need their help, that this is an issue we have as her constituents that we would like her help on. And this is, I mean, she's said this in multiple quotes, as opposed to saying she's the problem and the way we're going to solve it is to get her out of office, that this is something we want her to lead on. And she was frankly never hostile to that idea. It's just that in Republican circles, the question doesn't come up very much.
Right.
Right. She hadn't been approached that way before on that issue. And she was willing to listen and willing to learn. She has great staffers who are also willing to listen and learn. Together with her, we had meetings with climate scientists and with public policy people, with economists. She held a town hall meeting on the topic to hear from her constituents.
Mm-hmm.
And after about a year of that sort of investigation, she decided to join the caucus.
And so there's a bit of a political calculus that goes on in there. I mean, they sit down and they say, well, you know, if we embrace this, this topic, this issue, yeah, you know what? Maybe we'll get some more Democrats lean, you know, become a little more purple with us and we'll get some votes. But there could be some pushback, too,
right.
from some of our more hardline conservatives who don't believe in climate change. And so I'm sure they weigh that and they triangulate that and part of it. But it sounds like it was important to, again, compel her through respect and appreciation, civility versus antagonism and shaming.
Right.
That
right,
can also
exactly.
go on and does nothing
right.
to forward the position or help the position, right?
Right. And frankly, I think that's true in a lot of Republican offices.
Yeah.
I think in general, they don't need convincing on climate science.
Yeah.
They all know it already. What they need convincing of is exactly what you bring up, is the politics.
Yeah.
That it's not going to hurt them with their voters.
And probably the economics, too.
Right.
I'm sure they were like, all right, what's the cost-benefit analysis
right.
here? You know, show me again the numbers. And you guys certainly, Joe, you guys have no shortage of numbers to show the economic value of reducing our carbon footprint.
No, absolutely. Right. We've studied that, as have others.
So, yeah, okay. We make that point a lot, that not acting is expensive.
So yeah. Okay.
What other members of Congress have you been able to influence and bring online with this organization?
In Utah, none yet. Sorry, at the federal level, none yet. At the state level, Republican Becky Edwards of North Salt Lake has introduced a climate resolution in the Utah legislature. That failed in committee last year on a 5-5 vote. We hope to pass it out of committee this year.
You could say it won.
Yeah,
won a 5-5 vote.
Yeah,
right.
We won 5 votes.
Frankly, we got 3 Republican votes.
Yeah,
in committee for that bill.
I think she did consider that a win.
We certainly did.
But it was.
Absolutely.
And the thing is, it's just a resolution,
right?
It's not
But what are the things?
But the dam is breaking on this issue with the Republican Party.
I get it.
I mean, the soft and fuzzy is obviously that just basic respect and preserving people's dignity in terms of what they believe and don't believe. But what is it about the climate lobby that compels a more, you know, Republican, conservative person to jump in and come along?
So you mean what arguments do we lead with, or how do we begin the conversation?
Yeah, where does it start?
I think in addition to this, we need your help on this, the other main thing that's compelling to them is having other Republicans do it with them.
Yeah.
So the Climate Solutions Caucus now has 26 Republicans and 26 Democrats in it nationally. The rules of that caucus are you're not allowed to join unless you do it together with a member of the opposing party.
Oh, so you have to come as a pair.
You have to come as a pair, Noah's Ark style.
All right.
In addition to solving the climate problem, we want to just solve this problem of excessive partisanship in the country. Break down these walls that are making us tribal.
On things that shouldn't be partisan.
And unable to solve problems.
Yeah.
All right.
Interesting.
Final word. Got less than a minute. Your thoughts, Judd? Anything else you want to add?
No, just look for the additional information coming out in the paper and on our venue on October 8th. Please come. You won't be disappointed.
All right. Well, I apologize for getting you on with just not enough time. I had more questions about this issue. And I think, you know, if you're available, we're going to have you guys back, maybe back before your events.
We'd love to.
Or maybe post-event, too,
have
you on to give a debriefing on what goes on at the Temple Har Shalom on October 8th and October 15th, the Citizens Climate Lobby events. Tom Moyer, Judd Werner, Citizens Climate Lobby, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having us
Thank
on.
Thank you.
All right. Real quick break. Last one, and then we got to wrap up. It's This Green Earth.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by AMA Waterways and Park City Air Cruise and Travel, 565-4730, parkcityaircruiseandtravel.com. Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com. Fred Marshall Painting, painting Park City's home since 1974, fredmarshallpainting.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Time to wrap things up here on This Green Earth. Of course, let's thank our sponsors and underwriters who make this show possible. They include Recycle Utah,
Republic Services,
Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance,
Vail Epic Promise,
Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties,
San Francisco Design,
Park City Mountain,
and listeners like you.
Of course, listeners like you. Now, you can always join us on Facebook at KPCW This Green Earth, or
email us your thoughts, comments, and ideas at thisgreenearth@kpcw.org.
Remember, this is KPCW 91.7 FM in Park City. We've got your Wasatch back. And Carolyn, thanks again for co-hosting a great show today.
Pleasure. Thank you.
All right. Well, NPR News is coming up, and we'll see you all next week. Thanks again.